Welcome, folks, to episode 3682. I am a little more than 5 minutes late on the start today. I promise you it is not the fault of our guests. It's my fault. We were catching up on some things because they're friends in addition to expert council members and guests on the show. But I'm also completely discombobulated with all the things that have happened in the past 2 weeks and some family things and some other stuff. The schedule is blown, and I don't really know what day it is when I wake up this week. Turns out it is a Wednesday, so it's interview day. And I've got two of my favorite people, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, that I'll be bringing on in a moment. Before I do that, let's go ahead and mention our sponsors today. Sponsor today, number one today, is Above Phone. Above Phone is a way that you can take back your tech from the big carriers. You can also not just get a phone at Above Phone. You can also get tablets and laptops at Above Phone. The Above Book and the Above Pad. These are both great. They run their own own app store. You have apps, you can do everything you're used to doing on your phone or your tablet or your computer right now, except they're completely in a private app space. They're uncensorable. They don't spy on you. They don't steal your information. They don't report it to other people. But if you have an app that you need to use, you can still use apps from like the Google Play Store and things like that. You can even put them in their own little jail where they only do the things that they do when you turn them on and let them out of jail. And that way they can't run in the background and do things that they say they don't do and aren't supposed to do, but we all know they do. This is a great way to take back your tech. And if you're like, but Jack, I'm not technical like you. First of all, anybody that really knows how untechnical I am will laugh at you. But the reality is that Above Phone will provide you a specialist who will give you a free 1 hour consultation by phone to onboard you to your new device. Check them out today at Above Phone and take back your tech. Remember also, they do a discount for MSB members, and it's a damn good one. How about $75 off any phone at Above Phone? Next up today, you know, you might need some money to buy an Above Phone someday. Well, a great way to do that is to invest your money long term and be smart with it, have a long time preference, and build up your wealth. I know a great guy to teach you how to do that, John Pugliano, who is an expert council member, has been working with us here at the community level since 2010. So he's been around a while, call it 15 years. And with the Wealth Setting podcast, you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. It comes out a few times a month. It's short, 10 to 15 minutes an episode. Truly insightful, and it's the exact information that John uses as an investment manager to manage his money and his clients' money as well. Check it out at wealthsteading.com. With that, let's go ahead and bring our special guests on, plural today, Dr. Joel Alton, better known as Doc Bones, and Nurse Amy. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey.
Hey, thanks for having us, Jack.
Hey, it's been a minute since...
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a minute since y'all been on the air and since our hotel got blown away by a hurricane a few years ago. It's been a while since we've seen you in real life, too. For people that maybe are new to the show or what have you, Joe, you're a retired OB, pelvic surgeon. Amy's a nurse practitioner. You guys have spent your entire retirement years where most people would, like, you know, is successful out of the medical career, you'd be walking the beach or something. You've really spent all of this time helping people prepare medically for disasters. How'd you guys end up on this path?
Now, I want to tell you about that story, but first, I want to tell you about this book I'm reading
this
here.
This crazy book? I don't know. It just dropped from the sky one day. It showed up.
I just want to add just one thing. In chapter 13, he said something. You say something that I think is, or you say a lot of things in here that are, make a lot of sense. But you say here, live primarily in your circles of control and influence. Everything else is just awareness. Now, wouldn't everybody be happy in this world if we just did that?
It's true.
Right?
So words of wisdom.
Absolutely. But I have a problem. I got a bone to pick with you about this book. Jack, you say here to your editor, don't frick around with my voice. You know what I got to say to you? I got to say, language, young man. Language.
Did you read the introduction?
Yeah.
You also have a collector's item. That was the book that got out with the version inversion with all of the typos in it that probably are driving Joe near nuts. But anybody ordering the book now gets it with the proper typesetting and all of the errors corrected. But I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, love the book. And when did I tell you to write it?
You told me to write a book like 10 years ago, but I don't think he meant that kind of book either, though. He wanted me to write a preparedness book, which everybody
Well, you're a guru in that, too. And then gardening, the whole permaculture thing. Oh, my gosh.
You've got,
you're a jack of all trades, literally.
Right. Jack, you got a lot of books in you. Keep writing.
Yeah, I'm actually working on Laws of Life, too, right now. I was actually working on Chapter 2 before we got online together. So it's
All right, good idea, good idea. All right, looking forward to it.
All right, so how did we get started in this since we were all retired and, like, we were not laying on the beach drinking whatever Biden drank, though, beer. We didn't do that.
No, not in Delaware.
No. We got
I will tell you that I've seen Amy lay on the beach and drink, though. I've seen that.
Yeah,
I have, but under a tent. Yes. No sun.
Yes, with long sleeves, things, and Chardonnay.
Yes, only with you guys, though.
So I guess the question was, how do we get started on this?
Yeah, because we're retired. Like, right. How do we get into this?
Right. Well, I mean, I was first exposed to disaster medicine early in my career. You know, we had Hurricane Andrew come by in 1992. I was a member of one of the disaster medical assistance teams. They called them DMATs back then. For the aftermath of that hurricane here in South Florida. But since that time, we've seen, innumerable natural disasters, epidemics, pandemics, and are even faced with, for the first time in decades, the possibility of armed conflict one day in the China Sea, in Europe, all sorts of stuff, all these things that could lead to big trouble. And so it led me, I guess I started off, or we started off as hurricane preppers.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, hurricane prepper is somebody that has, instead of the 3 days worth of food and water and things like that, we had about a couple of weeks worth. And that's not an uncommon thing among Floridians here, even those that are not interested in preparedness,
Right.
But I've got to say, maybe Hurricane Katrina really hit us back in 2005.
It hit us here.
Yeah.
And, it was then that we saw what happens when the ambulance isn't just around the corner. I mean, that's not that there weren't providers and technology available. It's just they couldn't get to the victims due to flooding.
Right.
So, I mean, and we realized that any number of catastrophes could do the same thing. I mean, if you're in an earthquake, it's maybe impossible to get home from work.
Right.
The roads may be impassable. So any disaster with enough casualties can overwhelm the existing infrastructure. I mean, if there are three injuries in a multi-car accident in a two ambulance town, I mean, you got a problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we figured that we could teach the average person how to deal with injuries and illness in times of trouble and maybe put some supplies in their hand. And maybe avoid some tragic outcomes.
Right.
And so we put together a medical kit company. That's been doing well. And we started writing, and now we're up to more than 1,500 articles, podcasts, and videos over at doomandbloom.net.
He's the motivator.
that's why he's always on my ass about writing, because the guy churns out like a book a week in articles, right? So to him, everybody should be writing all the time.
You know? I know, right? It just flows from him. He's got some talent. I mean, obviously you do too. But it is a talent to write. I mean, of course, now everyone has AI, and they can just say, write me a book on tropical trees in Fort Lauderdale,
right.
300 pages.
Yeah.
I mean, but before that, you actually needed talent like you guys have.
I will tell you that AI makes writing easier without having it write for you, though. Like, when you have that one sentence, and you're like, it's clunky, and I don't like it, and but I have to say it, and it has to have all these things in it. And you say, rewrite this sentence for me, and it turns it into three, and you go, oh, that's why I couldn't write it, right? Because it needs, right? Or like when on my new book, one of the things I did is I made my list of laws, and then I went through with AI, and I parried them down to where they were shorter and punchier.
Right.
And then you can have the longer one as like a subtitle of the chapter. And then I said, okay, instead of me sitting here and figuring out what order to put them in, what order would you put them in?
There you go.
When I read it, I went, I disagree with one. I flipped one set of them and went, that's perfect. So it's a good tool for authors, but I agree with you. Like, if you have somebody just writing, you might as well just have somebody else write for you. Like, if you're going to let AI, and then AI, if you let AI write for you, like, as soon as you read it, you're like, oh, hey, I wrote that.
Yes. It's clear to me what's human and what's not.
Yeah.
It's very clear to me. You can tell when people are just using the AI.
You can talk in English or you can talk in AIEs.
AIEs.
Yeah. One of the hacks for that, and then we're going to move on back to medical stuff. But like, when you do have AI helping you, you can download a list of the most commonly overused words and phrases by AI and then like drop that in and say, do not use any of these words or phrases.
There you go.
Just don't say this stupid crap, you know, like
it's got to edit itself.
Take that out.
Edit yourself. That's funny.
So anyway, on this whole thing, like one of the things you're really known for other than your podcast and your website, which are both awesome, is your book. Like you guys co-authored this book and it's a comprehensive guide to long-term grid down situations. I often say when I talk about it, like, you know, you should get this book because if nothing else, if somebody breaks in your house and you can't get to your gun and it's near you, you can beat somebody to death with this book.
Yeah.
But yet it's written in a way that a layman that doesn't know a lot about medicine can read, comprehend, and understand. And, you know, I want you to talk about why you wrote the book, how it's different maybe than other books in this scenario. But I also want you to hit on something really important in your opening that – if you are in a medical emergency in a two ambulance town and there's three emergencies and you're number three, you have a problem. So grid down, meaning you can't get higher level of care, can be a week or a couple days, and you could still die in that time or get a lot worse. And even if you get higher level care and you don't die, you know, now you're dealing with sepsis or something else. So can you talk about how this book helps fill that gap, not just if we end up with something that becomes – like there would be fodder for like a TV series, right? It doesn't have to be Jericho. It doesn't have to be whatever the one was where the power went out. They were shooting crossbows at each other. It could just be an ice storm and you can't get out for 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we wrote this book for those exact situations. And you know, there are a lot of books on first aid, even for wilderness settings. And a lot of them are really quite good. I mean, there are a lot of super good books of the American Academy of Emergency Physicians. They put out a good book. But all of these books, even books like Where There Is No Doctor, fail to take into account that in a true survival scenario, long-term stuff, there's no access to modern medicine for the foreseeable future. And that becomes a problem when every chapter of the book ends with, and get to the hospital and get to the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, this is, and because a lot of these books are written by people with active medical licenses like we have, but who are younger and still have their career in front of them, you know, they don't want to omit that.
Yeah.
Even though it may be perfectly true that that's exactly what's going to happen. And so, you know, our entire book, the Survival Medicine Handbook, assumes that some disaster has occurred and you no longer have the option of accessing modern medical care, maybe for the long run. And it addresses the average citizen in plain English as to what you can do using sometimes ancient strategies, you know, things that may be obsolete today when you've got, you know, a heart-lung machine that can, you know, live for you, you know, while you're having your heart transplant, you know. And we did it all, like I said, in plain English, and we treat these, our reader, as if they're the last line of defense in a true disaster, a true long-term disaster. What do you got there?
We researched, like, old medical equipment. Mm-hmm. This is actually a glass syringe. Look at that.
Oh, wow.
With the, this is how the needles were. How scary is that? I know.
That's pretty terrifying.
I know, right? We did a lot of research.
Looks closer to a gamma globulin in each ass cheek. I mean, really, that's pretty terrifying.
Can you imagine? And there's all different sizes. I mean,
we have all sorts of stuff. We have bone saws from Civil War.
We have old stethoscopes.
Right. Tourniquets from World War II. We have an entire World War II medic.
Oh, yeah. Program. I don't know why there's like tubing here, too. I don't know if they were injecting things into the body cavity or trying to remove things from the body cavity. But this is a very old set. So anyway, we did research a lot of old techniques in case there wasn't electricity.
Right. Things that you could use off the grid in times of trouble.
Yep.
You know, I can't remember the guy's name. Francis Rindrind, the guy that invented the hypodermic needle. His wife became the first IV drug addict.
Oh, no. Are you serious? I'm not serious about that one.
Yeah. Yeah. His wife, I think it was opium. Because you could buy opium back then, just like Laudan. Right. You know, you'd get a bottle of it at the drugstore for a nickel or whatever. So he invented the needle. He was some doctor. And it was some of it, I think, in the 1800s or something. And
yes.
Oh, my God. Do you know what she was injecting?
His wife became the first IV drug addict in the world because there was no needle. And the first person with a needle, let's see what happens. Right.
Put it to work right away.
You know, some things should not just be in the hands of humans, you know? Oh, my gosh. Anyway.
All right. So, yeah, let's talk about how a long-term grid-down situation can change the way people need to approach medical care. Because what this makes you think of as a story, it wasn't even that long, but it was long enough for the guy to die. It was about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, there was a snowstorm that hit Chicago pretty hard. And it was this dude who was really overweight. And because of the snow, the ambulance could only get within like a couple blocks of where he was. And they literally, there was an audio recording of like his people arguing with 911, and they were saying, you need to drag this guy to us and maybe we can save him because we can't get to you. We don't know where you are, but here's where we are. And they wouldn't do it, and the dude died. If they had any level of capacity to provide care and maybe a deer sled to drag him through the snow, because the dude was like 400 pounds, he might be alive today.
Yeah, that's true. And
or even on sheets. I'm thinking you throw a blanket.
It's snow. And
it's on snow, exactly. And everyone just drags the blanket or the sheet or what. Oh, anyway.
Grab them by the shoulder or the coat, put them and drag it there. Well, anyhow, what's the difference? I mean, the difference is it's as simple as your final goal. What's your final goal? In normal times, when you come across somebody that's sick or injured, let's say broke their leg in a car accident, they're bleeding or something like that, what you want to do is you want to stabilize that person and get them to the nearest medical asset. And that makes sense. I mean, you're not a doctor after all. And once you ship the victim off your responsibility, that's been discharged and you're on your merry way. But what if that's not an option like you mentioned? I mean, you grid down, your responsibility extends from the point of injury to the point of full recovery. And basically, can you provide care for this person on a regular basis? Can you provide daily wound care? And that's something that
nursing care
person,
that
right,
and that moves into nursing care.
Right, exactly.
I mean, when you're in the hospital for 2 weeks or a month, the doctor's not in there changing your bandages and bathing you and helping you go to the bathroom if you can't get out of the bed. You know, then that moves into some nursing care, which is, you know, not like trauma and technology. It's more, you know, bedside skills. And we did put a chapter in this version of the book, the fourth edition, that is all about that. What are you going to have to be doing for this patient on a day-to-day basis to keep them clean, to keep their infection rate down, you know, to make sure they're hydrated and they're getting good nutrition so they can heal. So there's so many other things other than just, you know, throw the tourniquet on or put the SAM splint on. You know, there's things to help a person get better. And we also brought that into it. So, again, you can complete the care for the patient.
And it's not just the care for the next 5 minutes.
Right.
or the next hour. It's a care from the beginning of the injury, from the event that occurs, all the way to full recovery.
Right.
And that's something that you don't get from a first aid book, and that's something you don't get from most medical books, unless they're medical textbooks for a particular specialty. But we have it in our book.
And it's not exciting. Learning how to do a bed bath is not the most exciting thing. But you know what? There's a technique of how you're supposed to do it, and I put that in here.
It's not sexy, and it's not, sensational, but it's something that's going to save a life somewhere down along the road.
Yeah, I think one of the things people don't realize is what kills more people than anything else tends to be infections.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And things like bed sores that become... problematic, or wounds that it looked like it was healing, but next thing you know, it's got infection underneath it, and it goes septic. And some of these things can actually take people out, really, like cause multi-system organ failure and take people out really, really quick. And that's a big difference. And even some professional training, like I went to combat lifesavers training in the military, and it was like, dude has a sucking chest wound. What do? You yank his poncho out of his bag. You roll him up in his poncho to seal the so he can breathe. And then if he dies, he dies. He's waiting on a medic or he's waiting on a helicopter. I'm moving on to the guy and trying not to get shot. That doesn't work in these scenarios we're talking about.
Right.
Right, right. In there's probably not a lot of gunfire going on.
You need basically a chest seal to survive, to help that person survive long term.
Yeah.
Not just a chest seal, but you need a chest tube.
Exactly. Drainage. Okay. Keep the fluid off while it's healing.
And interestingly enough, we have some of the early procedures, step by step, of how to put together a chest tube and a chest tube drainage system without power in the book. So these are the things, the kind of stuff that we think about.
Right.
So basically, a lot of shit that you might have to do someday, but you shouldn't do unless you have to.
Like, oh, my gosh.
You should be left to doctors and ER personnel and paramedics and EMTs, but sometimes those guys aren't available.
This is not a self-help book. I just want to be clear. This is not a self-help book. This is not to help you avoid the doctor visit.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
In normal times.
Seek the doctor and the nurse practitioner or whomever is in your... you know, area, please.
Break glass in case of emergency. No.
Now, I had Amy lift her sleeve because
if I can get to it.
She had, for example.
I had a colonoscopy 4 weeks ago today.
Okay.
And they blew my IV. And the next day I had to go to the emergency room. My entire arm was swollen. And right here, the vein is still lumpy. And bruise. I don't know if you can see the bruise, though, because the color is not real good. But it's still bruised. 4 weeks. Yeah, I think you can see it. But anyway, you just never know. Even you go to the hospital, you get the doctors and the nurses to everybody take care of you. And then, you know, some crazy things happen. And then you got to do self-care at home.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Stuff
happens.
So, and it's like, but you guys say... before you even, like, get medical training or buy a bunch of supplies or whatever, you guys say, like, there's two things people should do. One is establish community, and two is get yourself as healthy as you possibly can. Get your personal basic health in order. Like, if you're the guy that we talked about being drugged through the snow, be probably better not to be 400 pounds. That might have saved his life alone, right?
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you're 7 foot tall and jacked and you're 400 pounds, maybe. But in general, humans are not. Even 7 tall and jacked, you probably shouldn't be 400 pounds.
Mm-mm.
Well, 7 tall and jacked also makes a big target.
Yeah.
That's true.
But why do you guys say that? Like, first community and self-health before you even worry about all this other stuff.
Well, I mean, as a community... well, let's take some examples from TV. I mean, have you ever watched the show Alone? Well,
where they just put them out in the wilderness and say good luck.
Right.
Yeah. Let us know when you give up.
Right. Yeah. In Alone, they drop you off alone, with some supplies, probably as much as a person could reasonably carry a fair distance. it plop you off into the off-gridest of off-grid situations. And that person has to, well, what does that person have to do? The person has to find water, they have to make it drinkable, he has to find food, mm-hmm. he has to cook it properly, he has to make a shelter, worry about personal protection from not just the elements, but from maybe bears, things
that.
Deal with injuries and other medical issues that just occur as a part of daily life. And so how much easier would it be to have a group of like-minded? If you took all 10 of the contestants from alone, they probably would have a better chance of putting together a community that would be able to last longer than this, you know, the starvation that they're going through than what they're doing alone.
I think that would actually make a better show, because then you could have interactions. These people, when they're alone, they're not talking
might make
a lot.
Show.
Have you watched the show, Jack?
I didn't watch it much because it's not my thing, the sensationalistic stuff. I've watched it a little bit because kind of in my niche I have to at least know what it's about. But I agree with you, like putting people together and then not voting each other out of the woods, because that's actually counterproductive.
Exactly. Yes. Why would you lose your member? Right. The one guy that can fish.
Right.
If you put me in a situation like that, I would be trying to recruit people.
Right, exactly.
Find the natives.
how much easier would it be to have a group of like-minded, you know, individuals with the common goal of surviving?
Right.
I mean, you know, a person alone can survive for a time, and we've actually seen that proven on that show, but it's a pretty miserable existence, and we've seen that proven on that show as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason Tom Hanks ended up with a volleyball as a friend.
Yes.
You're just not meant to be alone, right?
Right. Yeah. And I do see that a lot. A lot of these guys don't go home because they're starving. It's almost like they get past the starvation, they can handle it. I think it's the mental breakdown that you see most of them happen. They're just like, they can't take it mentally anymore. And that's why they leave.
Now,
we need people, honey.
That's right.
We need people.
You know, people have double chins, right? It's really bad when you have like a triple elbow. None of the people on that show have a triple elbow.
No.
They have some level of physical shape to survive, and that's it.
Yes.
Exactly.
So what do you have to do to get your personal health in order? I mean, well, a lot of the stuff that I hope you're doing already, eating a healthy diet, you know, you talk about paleo, that I think is an important thing. Exercising, staying away as much as possible from addictive substances. And on top of that, and this is going to be controversial to some of your folks, is I think you need to use the high tech that's available now to get you ready for the uncertain future. So if you got a bum knee, you're not going to last long in times of trouble. If you have bad eyesight, well, you know, you break your glasses and you're going to be in bad shape as well. I mean, for example, you know, I always recommend people to get the LASIK procedure or the PRK procedure to correct vision. I mean, when I was younger, I was blind as a bat, you know, and I had like a -4 nearsightedness, and it was, you know, my glasses were thick. Mm-hmm. And I got one of the first actually LASIK procedures that were ever performed. And the next day, I did surgery.
Oh, wow.
Without glasses. I did it. I did major abdominal surgery without glasses. And so, you know, now, even now I have the eyes of an eagle, you know, a very, very old eagle, but an eagle, an elderly eagle.
It's definitely something like that would help me that I would do. My vision problem is an optic nerve issue. So unfortunately there's not really anything that can
happen.
But if it was doable, yeah, I mean, I would love to actually see out the other side of my head. And, you know, and I do need glasses from a standpoint of like long distance vision.
Right.
But I know there's low risk, but I'm not risking my one good eye at all.
I do not blame you.
Well, but if I could correct, because it's not the vision in my right eye is like 20/30. At distance, and it's like 20/20 up close, like it's perfect vision up close. But my left eye, 2200, and my field of vision is about 35 degrees.
Wow.
Yes.
Right. So, like, somebody could do something. when somebody could do something and they don't, I feel kind of like you don't understand like how important it is to be able to actually freaking see.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
I agree. I'm telling you, I can't even see the veins on my hand without these readers now. But he doesn't need glasses because, did you tell him what you did?
Yeah.
He had one eye corrected. Well, he had both eyes fixed. That was the early procedure. But then how many years ago?
Like
7, 8?
Yeah. About 30 years ago, I did the
original basic one. Both eyes fixed, beautiful eyesight.
Now, your eyesight does change over the course of time as you get older. So about 5 or 6 minutes.
Before COVID.
All right, whatever.
7 years?
Yeah, maybe. I wound up having some rescission, and I needed to change the way I was doing it so I could read. And so what I did is I corrected one eye so that I could read, and one eye remained the same for long distance. And what happens is my brain takes over when I'm looking long distance. One side of my brain takes over when I'm looking long distance. The other side is taking over when I'm looking, you know, at a piece of paper, you know, up close.
So he's like the bionic man.
Yeah.
He's got one eye here that sees everything, and then the other eye sees everything out there. It's wild.
Yeah, so that's what I would do. If I had decent vision in both eyes, I'd probably have one done and make sure it was good and then do the other one, but that's not
it. It's like cataract surgery when people go and do both surgery. I mean, what if they go bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, my father-in-law, before he passed away, had that done. He said it was like somebody lifted a veil with cataract surgery. Wow. So things like that, or like you said, a knee or like a severe dental problem or anything like that. Fix those problems now because they can be bearable now, but during a crisis could become unbearable, and then you can't do anything.
Right.
That's right.
Right. There becomes no option.
And it affects your end chances for survival.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, like, how would people be able to, like, stockpile prescription antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals, maybe some special medications like insulin? And then when you start doing that, people worry about, like, shelf life. And I think you guys have pretty much busted that one, that pretty much medications last a very, very, very long time, longer than a label says.
Yeah, we've been talking about that for a long, long time. Now, basic insulins, for example, like regular NMPH, they're all over the counter in most states these days. And they're antibiotic and antifungal over the counter as well. Oral antibiotics and antifungals, for years I was talking about using veterinary antibiotic equivalents, but now, since those have been taken over by the government or eliminated, banned by the government essentially, now it's actually pretty easy to get a human antibiotics using the Wellness Company or Jace or any of the human companies that do it. It used to be a big problem, and it was one of the things that I used to recommend using fish antibiotics for. Now you can't use fish antibiotics, and they don't even make them anymore.
Well, I guess they had made them until recently, but that company that we had recommended, who we knew the owner, closed his doors, 48 hours ago?
Right.
Last day, 48 hours ago. And we knew him for 15 years. We've known him since like 2010. Fishmox Fishflex. Yeah, they got a letter, and they clearly said in the email, we received the letter, and we have until this date to sell what we have, and then we're closed.
Now, the funny thing about it is the government, the reason that they use for removing all these fish antibiotics and other veterinary antibiotics that were being stockpiled by humans for preparedness purposes, the reason why they knocked them off is because they said, well, these are new animal drugs. We never knew about them.
What?
Yes.
Because they had a different brand name. Even though the ingredient is something that's been around for
Amoxicillin for
70 years. Right.
So they said Fishmox. Well, that's an absolute.
We don't know what that is.
That's a new drug. And so what they did is we invite you
to apply
for a license.
Right.
You know, which probably would cost, like, you know, how much it probably costs these insurance, pharmaceutical companies to apply to the government to have something approved by the FDA.
I don't know.
Probably a lot of money, and it's just probably not worth it. So I'm not expecting any fish antibiotics to be available soon.
I think everybody's given up.
But there are doctors that'll toss antibiotics at you, and you know all you
there's
have to
a few
do,
companies now.
You know,
or I think there's
how this works. I've seen some advertised on like cable news channels and stuff.
Yeah.
Like one's called Duration Health, and like basically you get a whole kit.
Yes.
You know, somewhere
yes.
A few hundred to a couple $1,000, depending on what you want. And it's antibiotics, it's pain relievers, it's antivirals, antifungals. Like,
yeah.
And a lot of this stuff is stuff that is prescription.
Right.
They're and all prescription.
It was locked up tighter than a monkey's butt. You couldn't get your hands on it unless you knew somebody that would write the prescription for you. And now, like, you can call in, give them your Amex card, and they'll mail it to your house. How did that all happen?
Well, I will say one thing. I don't think that you can get pain medicines. I have gabapentin because it's not an opioid, but you're not going to be getting Percocet or Xanax or
Dilaudid,
you know, you're not going to get
or
morphine. But you might be able to get gabapentin out of them. But other than that, it's going to be, you know, antibiotics, antifungals.
What happens is they have you fill out an application.
Mm-hmm.
Then they decide whether you need a televisit or not.
Which
I have a feeling they mostly don't do.
They probably don't do because it's just easier for them. They don't have to take time doing it. So if you basically on your application just say that you're completely healthy and you just want it as for emergency situations,
right?
Places like the wellness company, you know, and
they'll give you 30 tablets of amoxicillin and 60 tablets of metronidazole.
Now the problem with that is twofold. Number one, they'll do it only once a year for you.
Okay.
They only give you one course
per person.
One course of each antibiotic, for example.
Okay.
So, you know, from the standpoint of the survival medic, who is in charge of a survival group, that person is basically stuck with this limitation in terms of numbers. I mean, in reality, what you need to be able to do is to buy bottles of 100 amoxicillin, you know, 100 doxycycline, you know, and those are the things that you could do when the fish antibiotics were around. But it's not something you can do now. Now you get one course of antibiotic, of each antibiotic, although they may give you several different antibiotics, and they'll do it no more often than, I think, once a year.
Supposedly.
And so it makes stockpiling
it. They're trying to follow. They're trying to not get in trouble. And I think they're all, and it's funny, they're all doing the soft case.
Yeah.
Every single one of them has the same zippered soft case, pretty much the same.
There's one supplier for all this stuff and a bunch of brand names, right?
And you know what? They're all coming probably from the same Chinese manufacturer.
Oh, I bet.
You know, prepackaged, they just slap the label.
The quantity limitations, I kind of think back to my military days again. Like, every soldier has, they call it a first aid kit. It's not a first aid kit. It's a fucking bandage. That's all it is. It sits right up here under LDE, and it's a compression bandage.
Yes.
It is not for the guy you see laying on the ground with a wound. The one on him is the one for him.
Right.
So if you have to apply that pressure bandage, and for all I know, they have much better equipment today than they did 35 years ago, right? 40 years ago. Anyway, but it was, you carry, 35 is right, I think. Anyway, you carried your own medical supplies. And then the same with like the atrophine, basically, that you would give somebody on a chemical attack. You carry your own, and then that gets used on you. So if you had a group that wanted to have this in stockpile, it would be best for each person to have their own, and then maybe you take that with you when you go to your community medic or something, because
so that would
he can't compile it for you.
So that
right,
would take,
right,
take,
exactly.
That would take a lot of organization, and that's indeed part of the medics, the survival medics' responsibility, is to get these people organized, make sure they have their own IFACs and the materials for the IFACs so that you can carry the advanced stuff on you as the medic.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right, and it makes the most sense to do it that way.
I would like to mention something about these companies, which is really awful. We have an ability to buy wholesale medications. Like, I can buy 1,000 amoxicillin, but I'll tell you,
licensure.
Yeah, yeah. Because I, you know, we can do it. We have prescription authority. So I can order 500 amoxicillin and 1,000 tetracycline and whatever we want.
Yeah.
Not Xanax, not Vicodin, yeah, not Percocet, you know, like antibiotics, antifungals. And I'll tell you what, the price, I can get 100 amoxicillin. It's like $2.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so the prices that these prescription companies in these little cases are charging are disgusting.
It's a racket.
It makes me sick to know how much they pay for those pills, because I've got the prices in the list right there.
And if anything, they're paying less than you are because they're buying cases, right?
Yeah.
It's sick what they're charging hundreds of dollars for pills that cost pennies. It makes me sick. But anyway,
that's
what they're saying. Their money is raining down on them because they are the ones, I guarantee you, got rid of the companies like the Fishmox, Fishflex. I guarantee you, at least one of those companies called somebody reported them and said, they're selling antibiotics to people and they're not using them for fish. You know that happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sadly, anyway.
Let's talk about some, do you recommend any formal training, intensive training for civilians so that they can be better at this?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of municipal courses that are available in many places that give you CERT training, community emergency response team training. And most of the time they're either free or they're next to free. And they'll tell you the basic stuff that you need to know. But remember, the thing that's important to know about all these training courses, and even short courses, wilderness courses, we've taken wilderness medicine courses for doctors. Mm-hmm. And basically what they're there for is for what? For stabilizing and transport.
That's what it is.
So I know we learned basically a million ways to transport.
But, oh my gosh, how to tie people up and how to wrap them up with using ropes and tarps and sleds.
But from a survival standpoint, you need to know what to do with that broken leg, how to set it, how to put together a cast. You need to know how to deal with it to prevent infection there.
Maybe traction.
How to produce traction for some of these people. And you need to be able to deal with them from the beginning to the end. That's not what you learn in these courses, but they're useful. But always have in the back of your mind, what do I do now that this person
after
has,
you get them to the stable place,
off.
Right?
How about if they were shipping them off to me?
Right, right.
And so that's all in our book, and that's another thing, by the way, that makes our book different and pretty unique compared to other books.
You know what we didn't talk about is, and he did ask, is how do people store them? Obviously, we talked about the company that are expensive, but the other technique that we've talked about in the past is when you have a prescription, and obviously you get that from the doctor, you can pick up your prescription earlier than, let's say, you get 30 pills. You don't have to wait to the 30th day and you're taking that last pill to go get your prescription. So there's an earlier date. Sometimes it's 7 days, 5 days, but there is an earlier date. And every time you go get it earlier, those extra pills, you know, can end up being storage on the back end. Obviously, you want to take your old pills first,
sure,
then open up the new bottle. But after a few months, you may have a whole bottle that you just picked up, but you've still got most of your other bottle. So you, if you keep doing that, and what you can do is ask the pharmacist when you pick up the prescription, when's the first day I can come back and get a renewal, mm-hmm, you know, a refill? And they should know because the insurance tells them the first day. Because
yeah,
I've tried to get things refilled, and they say, oh, you can't get this for two more days or three. They know when you can come back. So ask them.
Exactly.
And then all those extra pills that you haven't taken yet, you keep taking those, but you keep the new one, and it piles up. So
yeah,
believe it or not, that actually can work.
I also would say that, like, one of the rules we have is if one of us does have to go to the doctor and they want to prescribe something, whether we're going to take it or not, we take the prescription.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Well, like if you get injured and they'll say, well, we're going to give you some pain medicine, because that's like the hardest shit to get somebody to prescribe. And
yeah,
you're like, I don't really hurt that bad. Maybe I'll take one tonight. We still, whatever they write, and if they include a refill, we freaking refill it.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, because you don't know when you're going to need it. And when you,
yeah,
need it is when you usually can't get it.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. And just go.
You're a wise man, Jack Spirko.
I had a prescription I had to pick up for an issue, and the silly pharmacy, every 5 days, they kept telling me I was had a refill available.
Go get it.
So I was like, okay.
Go get it.
Refill, you know, because they texted you, your refill's available, and text, yes. I was like, yes. So I go get it, and then 5 days later, I get another text. I was like, yes. I did that like five times.
Didn't figure it
and
out.
And they didn't even like pick up that I was like in there every few days picking up the same prescription. I was like, okay.
Fine. I'll take it. What yeah, about like looking at the herbal side? Like herbs have some real strong usage cases and they also have some limitations. But like I don't even think about like a hydrocortisone or something if I have like an ant bite or a mosquito bite or a, you know, comfrey leaf and that works better and faster. Any thoughts on that? I know that's more in Amy's wheelhouse than Joe's as far as like growing your own herbs and things like that.
I'll tell you one of my favorite thing. I mean, I've got a few. Like, lavender is very relaxing. You make a lavender tea. Chamomile mixes really well. Passion flower, peppermint. I've personally used several times with just a couple of drops. I know you're supposed to mix it with a carrier oil because
yeah,
it can be strong. And that's fine if you want to do that if it bothers your eyes, but just a couple of drops here. I also put it on washcloths and then push the washcloths into the freezer. And then so when you put it on, you know, I always do migraine is the neck and the forehead with the two washcloths with the peppermint oil on it really helps. Arnica, I was putting arnica on this bruise to try and get this healing. So arnica oil is great. Arnica you want to use on intact skin, though. That's really important.
Right.
You're not supposed to use it on open skin.
And you have to use that relatively frequently. Because the
yeah,
effect isn't too long-lasting.
No, it's not right. It's not going to last you 8 hours.
I just have to say that our general philosophy, and it's reflected in all of our books, is that we are very much for integrative medicine.
Yes.
And the use of
right,
herbs that the family medic should consider either growing or have a supply in their
yeah,
storage. And so, you know, there are a lot of different ones, and there a lot of them have a lot of hard scientific data.
Oregano
behind
oil
them.
Is it like supposed to be like a really good antibacterial and antifungal? That's recommended a lot. Oregano oil is a really big
raw
one.
Honey, garlic,
oh,
all these
honey,
things are those are two natural
for
substances
wound healing,
that have really proven antibiotic properties, so accepted scientifically that even the drug companies put together their own medical versions of honey.
Yeah, MediHoney, right? They use in the hospitals for burns, and
yeah,
also MediHoney is supposed to be the best treatment topically for staph infections because so many of these staph infections have become bacterial resistant because they've been exposed to so many things. They've developed resistance that, you know, sometimes the raw honey is the only thing that actually will treat a staph infection, topical staph infection.
And there are
in
just,
a wound.
There are just so many natural herbs, a lot of them which are growing wild in your own backyard, maybe, that have medicinal benefits that we've devoted several sections.
Oh, we have so many chapters in here on them.
And we even talk about how to grow a medicinal garden.
How to make tinctures.
Every medic should grow a medicinal garden. Select a well-drained, sunny area to plant. Some herbs honestly grow well in shade. I have to say that. But most plants will need like 6 to 8 hours of full sun for proper growth and development. You want to pot some of these medicinal plants because in case you have to transport them inside during a cold winter. And, amend the soil. Get some red worms. Mix some coconut core.
I'm glad you brought that up. I love my worms.
That's right. Yeah, coconut core.
I feed my worms.
that's great.
Everything from the kitchen that isn't like meat and greasy.
Yeah.
All the leftover peels and food we didn't eat all goes into my. I just dig a little hole and throw the food in there and cover it up. And the worms just eat it directly and turn it right into compost right there in the pot with the food.
You want to have your compost pile.
Yep.
Stay away from, I don't know about you, Jack, but I stay away from carnivore,
poop
and things like
no,
that.
No, we don't do that. Well, we don't have chickens either. We don't have, the chickens are good.
Dog poop goes in the yard, wherever they drop it, it stays there. But, herbivores, even omnivores like chicken, because chickens do eat a lot of beyond just, but that works really good in compost. So we did a really long time.
Chicken poop.
Some of the things that herbs do that are really amazing, and like Lawrence Wells's book on Confrian, Lawrence Wells is the guy that really created the term balking for different Confri strains. Like in his book toward the end, he talks about these trials he did that were literally illegal to do in the UK at the time with old people who were going to die anyway. They were like in nursing homes and at end of life stage, and they had bad bed sores. This is like the 50s, I think, is when he was doing this work. And so he was able to get permission to use Confri ointment on these people who were, bed sores that wouldn't heal.
Right.
Even though it was against UK law because it was against their medical, he wasn't a doctor. He was a PhD doctor. He was able to get permission to put ointment on these. And these wounds that wouldn't heal on people at end of life stage where they have the least capability to heal, it healed these wounds. It's a dermal regenerator. Like there are things in nature that are incredibly powerful. And
so
I think they tend to be better for chronic things than they are for acute. Like I've always said, if I have a yield site in my spleen, please take me to a surgeon fast so I don't die. I don't bleed out. But if you have the chronic rashes and things like that, a natural approach will often be a better approach.
Absolutely. Page 81, Comfrey.
Oh, my God. I started breaking out with eczema in November. Oh, my gosh. To not have something and then suddenly it's like all over your face and your neck and your arms and your legs. And they're like, is it psoriasis? Is it eczema? And like, I don't know. It's eczema, I think. But it's just so frustrating. So I'm doing the herbal thing.
I also want to say worm castings are great.
Yes.
For your garden. They contain a mixture of bacteria and enzymes and remnants of plant matter, all sorts of substances. So they're rich in plant nutrients, and we use worm castings.
The other thing we add.
One thing. Oh, go ahead.
No, I don't know if you were going to say this. Mycorrhizae.
Very important.
Yes, because we do potted. We do a lot of gardening in
We have we have the outside garden. We have the inside containers shaded.
The containers, don't get the mycorrhizae fungi, which is what feeds the roots the carbohydrates, and they exchange nutrients with the roots. And it's, I think, 90% of life on the planet, plant life, survive because of mycorrhizae fungi bringing these plants that are maybe far away from any kind of source of water and nutrients.
But there's a learning curve to all this stuff, and you don't want to begin your medicinal garden after the hits the fan.
Yeah.
You want to get that going. You want to learn the plants that will match
survive
the climate where you live. I mean, we're way hot down here. A lot of people have very short summers up there. So you know, it's very important to make sure that you're matching the climate. You know, every plant has its place.
Yeah.
So you guys have on your notes here, and I just happen to have a question from anyone can golf at the same time about dentistry. That's probably big time overlooked by people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, that I think is one of the main issues that you have. 90% of dental emergencies are situations that can be dealt with by basically either simple things, you know, using dental wax to help a loose tooth, to be able to, I would say, deal with a lot of dental emergencies like a broken tooth or a loose tooth or actually even decay. You can actually have a kit that allows you to deal with a lot of this stuff. Now, 90%, I'll have to say, of dental emergencies that you're going to come up with can be treated with extraction. And that is something that in the old days, and I'm not talking about Roman times, I'm talking about maybe 60 or 70 years ago, the go-to thing to do was to extract a bad tooth. Now, yeah. Today they're trying to save every tooth, and we've been the beneficiary of that. I actually had a dentist save a tooth of mine just recently. But the truth is that in a survival setting, you're going to want to do a lot of tooth extracting because it is, I mean, you may not think it's, you know, life-threatening or anything like that, but it affects work efficiency like nobody else's business. I mean, when you have a toothache, there are times that you can think of nothing else but the pain that's in your tooth. And do you want to just take, like in the Tom Hanks movie Castaway, you want to take an ice skate, you want to just
by the way, that won't work. That'll just break the tooth.
Break it. It's just going to break it, and the root's still going to be in there.
Yeah.
So you're just going to bust a piece off.
So we actually tell you in our book, how to deal with the knocked out tooth, loose tooth, tell you how to deal with tooth abscesses, how to incise and drain tooth abscesses, how to extract a tooth. We even go to the point of telling you where to stand if you're extracting a tooth on the right versus where to stand if you're extracting a tooth on the left, if it's in the front of the mouth, if it's in the back of the mouth. What are the extractors that you would use for a tooth that had three roots versus a tooth that had only one root, like, let's say, your front tooth? You know, so we go well in depth, and I don't think there's any other book. That's where we're absolutely the most unique book. There's not a book that does as extensive a coverage of dental issues in times of trouble off the grid than our survival medicine handbook.
Can we talk about some things that are going on recently that made me think of you guys? And you brought them up in our pre-show discussion too. One is, and I don't know a lot about exactly what happened. I just heard about this yesterday afternoon. Some Chinese researcher brought in some fungus that apparently is being called an agro-terrorist weapon. Is this like a threat to humans or only plants? Is there anything that we can do about stuff like that? Like, because that just seems, you're talking about a bioweapon, basically.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I have to tell you about bioweapons, okay? A bioweapon doesn't have to kill you directly. It can be targeted, like this stuff that was brought in by these two Chinese people. I've got this paper in front of me because I can't pronounce their names. I'll pronounce their first names, which is actually in China their last names, Jian and Lu.
Okay.
And these are two people that brought in something called Fusarium graminearum, and I'm not pronouncing that completely right, I'm sure, but basically what it does is it destroys the heads of wheat, barley, affects corn. It causes a blight, and what a bioweapon doesn't have to kill you directly as a human being. All it has to do is unleash let's say I unleashed a horde of locusts into your community. I would probably remove all methods, all the food available in your community that, or at least agricultural products that can be harvested, and I could starve you out that way.
Right.
And so basically what these guys are trying to do is to cause a pandemic among wheat and barley that would cause, you know, significant issues in the United States. And this is just the ones that we've caught. I mean, there are probably, for every one of these that we catch, there are probably 20 of them that get through with some kind of toxin. And let's talk about what's the ideal biological weapon. I mean, it's got to have some certain characteristics. It's got to be infectious or contagious to either plants, livestock, or humans in a large percentage of those exposed. This stuff here, if you put it in a wheat field or a barley field, it kills everything. There. That's got to cause long-term debilitation or death of the infected organism. It does that to wheat and barley, and then by extension to everything that eats wheat and barley. And what it does to humans and livestock that eat it, it causes liver toxicity. It causes reproductive health issues in terms of causing abnormalities in pregnancies. And it causes a number of other issues that make you sick. And the other thing is it has to have few available antidotes or preventatives or cures. And in reality, once you get it into a field, then that field is pretty much done. So there you've got that. It matches. It's so far match everything, every single criteria for the ideal biological weapon. Has to be easily deliverable to.
I mean, look at how tiny these bags
are. Yeah,
look at this.
For those that are on the audio only, I've got a picture up of these little baggies they found with this shit in it. And I look at this and go, you know, if they didn't pack it in little baggies like this, they probably wouldn't have got caught. Like, you could take that little speck of black shit and put it, like, in a ballpoint pen, pull the bottom off, that little hollow spot, stick it in there and put it in there. That would have never been found.
Or an empty shampoo bottle, and then they just cut open the shampoo bottle. You know, I mean,
there's no dog would have found that or something. They're not trained to sniff that out. Like, and, you know, it's actually scary, not because they caught it, because of how easy it would be to get away with it.
Oh my gosh.
So what you just said fulfilled the next criteria. That is that it has to be easily deliverable to the area or population that's targeted. And sure enough, it is. Couldn't be easier. And this was actually a stupid way to try to bring it in. Yeah, and any of the ways that either of you mentioned would have been better. And the good thing is, for the last thing, it has to have a low likelihood of causing damage to those who are using the agent on others. And sure enough, number one of the guys that there was a man and a woman, the one of the man actually is already back in China. So guess what? You think we have an extradition treaty with China? No. So all they managed to do is get the guy's girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can just see the Chinese government going, I don't know, we have 1.7 billion people here, 1.7 billion people. We can't find them.
And this this is the one person or two people.
Yeah.
How many times is this? If you looked at the border crossings during the 4 years that the border was just wide open, and all the Chinese men that you saw pouring in, and pouring in and pouring in more than we ever had before. How many of those people in those backpacks they were all wearing were just walking across our border with this stuff? We have no idea what is here.
And if something can happen by accident, it can happen by intent. So if you think back to, like, the chestnut blight wiped out all the chestnuts in the United States except this little pocket that was kind of isolated in the Northwest, right?
Right.
Like, that wasn't even intentional. That was just me like, oh, this is a Chinese chestnut tree. I'll bring this here and plant it. That's all that it took. So that one little smudge of black, sooty, fungal shit, you could literally walk into somebody's wheat field smear it on one head, it'll begin to do what funguses do, which is reproduce themselves and spore out.
Yeah.
And even if it took a couple seasons, it could become a major agricultural problem in the United States. Now you look at that and go, man, like, what is China's angle on that? Like, to make their, like, do they already have an antifungal for their grain? Do they already have a GMO? Like, because one of the things you want, you were talking about the ideal bioweapon, you want to be able to use it on your enemy, but not have it hurt you.
And come back at you, right.
Right. Well, right. It would take a pretty darn long while to get back to China from Nebraska.
Yeah.
Or from Michigan, where. Listen, I just want to say a couple of things, that this is a well-known virus, a fungus. It is not something that they just made. It causes billions of dollars worth of damage to livestock and crops globally every year. But the one thing that makes it clear to me that this is something malicious is they found an article on the phone of the guy that actually made it out to go back to China. And that title of that article is Plant Pathogen Warfare Under Changing Climate Conditions.
Interesting. Interesting.
Warfare is the word.
So this is a fungus we already have.
Yes.
In the United States.
Yes.
Okay.
Right now, at least. So that's that. And so this is something the Chinese government denies that it has anything to do with it, of course. But of course they would.
But if you wanted to develop it into a more virulent strain or something like that, then the ideal thing to do would bring a sample of it in and do your development in the United States, because it would be much easier to get and have plausible. I don't know. It already exists. Like, if you were bringing in a engineered strain of this, then it would be very obvious what you're doing. And they have plenty of presence here in our country right now. They've bought farmland all over the place, which is kind of on the money there with that problem too. They also have, you know, quite a bit of, like, there's fairly large Chinese presence in some areas of the United States, and most of those presences are not far from U.S. military installations.
And they're also not far away from, and they're also related to most of our larger universities. So, for example, this stuff was going to the laboratory at the University of Michigan where these people were studying. So this kind of stuff is serious stuff. We probably catch 1 out of 20, and for some reason we haven't just gotten to the point that they haven't destroyed entire crops.
And that was like Bro's cover story too. Like, first he said he didn't know what it was. Then he said, "Oh, I know what it is, and I'm taking it to the lab to work on it." Right? Like, I wouldn't say that at the beginning if that's what you were really doing. But maybe he was going to take it to the lab and work on it because, you know, he probably could develop it into a more effective bioweapon right here at the University of Chicago or whatever.
Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Tweak it. Just tweak it.
What about this ass clown that made his, like, own version of a flamethrower?
Oh, my gosh.
And set people, like, this dude that was, like, an elderly gentleman on fire and was screaming Free Palestine. Like, that's another, like, new threat, I guess, that we have to worry about people firebombing shit and what have you.
Yeah, I think that everybody has to, if you haven't heard about situational awareness and the OODA loop, you know, you have got to get hip with that, because we're walking around with our cell phones in our hands, and we're usually not even looking up. We're probably walking into lampposts and stuff like that. But you always have to be really in a state of, we won't call it red alert, we'll call it yellow alert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you just be aware of your surroundings, of people around you, and when people start acting strangely, you know, you take note and you avoid them. This guy took his shirt off and had, you know,
he took his shirt off because he was on fire.
Yeah.
Because the moron, when he went to throw it, caught himself on fire as he was lighting. I'm not sure if it was a man or a lady, the first one, but he was on fire. So that's why his shirt came off.
Well, you know.
But where was somebody to body slam this guy or bear spray him or something?
Dude, this ass in the face with a 9mm. That would have stopped.
Wasn't this in California? Where was
it? I thought it was Colorado.
All right.
Well, oh, yes, you're right. It's Boulder. I should remember this. My daughter lives in Denver. Boulder is very non-gun carrying.
No one had guns there. These people, even though, you know, they're the particular side of the issue on Palestine that they're on, that were protesting, you know, they may not be liberal, may not be conservative, but they are peaceful protesters. And there's a difference between peaceful protesters and what they call mostly peaceful protesters, which are, in other words, very violent protesters. And if you're going to be in one of these protests, or you're going to be walking by one of these protests, you don't have to be in it, you always have to mentally map out routes of escape as you walk along. I mean, where's the nearest side street? Is there a building that you can, or, you know, go into, a subway entrance maybe if you're in New York? If you don't know the area, move away to where you might know the lay of the land a little better. These are things that are important. I mean, if you have to make your way through a crowd, stay on the fringes. This guy threw a Molotov cocktail in the middle of the protests. And so the people that are in the middle of the protests, not only are they... Are you going to get the most casualties by throwing something there? But these people are not in control of their movements. Wherever the crowd moves, they control your movements. And so always stay on the fringes of the crowd. And, you know, that's the thing. Because if you don't, other people are deciding your movements, not you. You want to also avoid confrontation with these guys, and that's, I guess, what these people were doing. You really don't want to avoid confrontation.
I'm sorry,
You want to take them out.
I'm not a big guy, but there is nothing that would have stopped me from body slamming this guy if I saw him light an old person on fire. There isn't God himself that would have been able to stop me from throwing myself into him and beating him over the head with his Molotov cocktail.
Now, I agree with you in that case, but however... If you're wearing your MAGA hat and you're walking into a crowd of 500 anti-Trump protesters, probably should take your hat off.
Yeah, there's a situation.
Unless you're ready to rumble. Unless you're ready to rumble.
Yeah. This guy here, I looked at him and I thought, I'm with Amy on that, but it wouldn't have been a beating.
What?
It would have been a throat grab, a step behind, and a cracked head like a coconut on the ground.
Right, and then you just get a hold of one of those.
Second. Like everything I was taught to not do in martial arts, so I wouldn't hurt my opponent when we were training, I would have done the exact opposite to that person. There would have been a skull-shattering crack for a person like that.
He was standing around holding it with his shirt off, and everyone's just circled around. I'm like,
no, everybody's. Everybody's doing this, right?
What is wrong with you people?
Everybody gets the phone out. Someday there's going to be a comet coming to end all life on Earth, and there's going to be 10 million people getting it for Snapchat or whatever.
I just couldn't believe that the guy was just able to like be walking around in the grass with his shirt off, holding these things, and nobody was attacking him.
You
see two responses, right, depending on where things like this go down. And it's not always like a big terrorist thing either. Like, I love that too. We're not really sure it's terrorism. Yeah, you are. The guy was – he was illegally in the country. He was a foreign national. He was screaming free Palestine when he set people on fire. We don't have to debate this. But even like garden variety shootings, I see two primary responses. Everybody just kind of like gets away and ignores it and it's not my problem. Or you've got the armed citizen that ends it. Like, that's real. I don't see a lot of middle ground happening in these situations. Like, there was a shooting at a church in Texas about 3 years ago. And it was, unfortunately, two people lost their lives. And then the third person lost their life was a gunman. Because somebody in the church was armed and immediately just capped his ass. Like, so to me, like, one of the best things you can do, I agree with Bones, stay aware, don't provoke. If you know it's a situation where something you're wearing or doing would instigate 500 people trying to kill you, don't do it. Right. The other side is, you know, in the words of Winnie the Pooh, stay strapped, right? Like, you know, Winnie the Pooh was always strapped. He had a shotgun, like, and know how to use it. I think it's important to learn how to heal injuries as to cause them, right? Yep. Like, and there are people that need an injury caused. Like, I'm sorry, I have no sympathy. You're trying to light somebody on fire, you're getting either a 357 SIG between your eyeballs, or if I'm closer, maybe you're getting your head cracked. Like, and we need to have, like, and the thing about guns is that people get in this weird state of, like, I got a gun, I got nothing to worry about. Yeah?
Right.
Okay. That's an interesting story, but if you don't know, one, some level of martial combat capabilities, because you can't always draw a gun before somebody gets their hand on your wrist, for instance, right? And the other side of it is that, you know, you can't always draw a weapon in the situation that you're in. Some, and then the last thing is, one thing you better understand when you start carrying a gun, there will be a gun at every fight you're in. Just because it's yours doesn't mean that it can't harm you, right? Like, you need to be able to understand how to control the weapon, when to deploy the weapon, when not to, things like that. That's all super important as an armed citizen. And the training you get for your permit or whatever is not sufficient for that. That's to make sure you're not going to shoot yourself or somebody else accidentally in the ass. And it's not even really great for that. Like, you should take additional training is what I'm getting at.
Yes, yes.
Other things I think are important in situations like this is you probably should always have sneakers on or some way that makes you mobile. I mean, the only person that's wearing women, the only people that are wearing heels are reporters, okay, at these events. So make sure you're well clothed so that, first off, also your skin is protected also, because, you know, if they're starting to, you know, spray pepper spray, things like that, you know, you can really, you know, get into trouble.
That's another thing. If you have to go, if you're really driven to be in a protest, and it better be something like serious that you seriously believe in, and you feel like you have to be in a protest, at least in Colorado, everyone's got bear spray. Every single one of those people who are peacefully protesting
bear spray around
could have
neck.
Had the bear spray. You have to have bear spray hiking in Colorado. I know when my daughter goes hiking, she lives in Denver, she carries bear spray with her. And, you know, she's clear never to go into any protests or any groups or anything, but, you know.
The only people that care.
I like to protest and all, but I'm going to just tell you that no one gives a shit.
Nobody. It's never going to change a mind.
People go protest and then the world changed. Like,
it is never. I would like to know one person, just one person who said, you know what? I watched that protest, and you know what? They changed my mind. I believed in this, but now because they were chanting, I now believe in that. It is never helpful for anything ever. It's 100% waste of everyone's time and money.
The only person that wants to be at a protest is somebody, honestly, that would is
has
not
nothing
afraid,
else to do.
Not afraid to harm somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
I mean, there's exceptions, but they were more like big, giant macro movements like Gandhi's March to the Sea and stuff like that. Like, that had an impact. But like these things where everybody start chanting like adolescent phrases and shit, and holding up cardboard signs and all this. There is no need to do this because at the worst case scenario is you end up dead. You might also end up in jail. You might end up severely injured. But what you're not going to do is further your cause. So
never.
If something has downside risk and no upside potential, that falls under my rule of don't do stupid things in stupid places with stupid people, right? It now qualifies for all three of those with no upside, right? So, like, if you're going to rob a bank, you're probably doing a stupid thing in a stupid place with a stupid person, but at least the upside is you might get away with a bunch of money, right? Right? You go to a protest, maybe, I guess, if you're one of those people, maybe you get away with a big screen TV. It ain't worth it. It isn't.
So maybe they just want their 15 minutes on television.
I don't know, but I know that I have never driven past people chanting anything and changed my mind.
Never.
Ever.
And I bet no one has. Ever. Yeah.
In fact, what I always think is, don't you have something you could be doing useful? Right.
Like, you have nothing else to do. They're
it
like,
doesn't
oh,
matter when I agree with them. It actually makes me less likely to support the thing I agree with already when I see them out there, like, you know, like the rhyming four beat chants and stuff. Like, you sound like you're 12. You sound like you're holding your breath because you didn't get extra ice cream.
Like a 2-year-old.
I want to say just a little something about law enforcement at these protests. I mean, if they're there And if you're in the on the wrong end of the protest, you don't necessarily want to run towards the law enforcement officers because they're not going to be able to hear you above the roar of the crowd.
Yeah.
And, you know, you better have your hands like this so that people could see. And so these guys can see that you are not a threat to them, because if you're a threat to them, or if they can't tell if you're a threat to them, they may act as if you're a threat to them. So that's something that's important.
Yeah, because they're in a heightened state of awareness of, like, who's the bad guys and who's the good guys here, and they can't always tell.
Oh, yeah, my hair,
they don't always
hair
know.
On my back, on my back of my neck would be up on end if I was in their situation.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just that type of thing.
I mean, what was it, 7 years ago where we had the protest here? It was, like, related to the statue bullshit and all in Fort Worth. Huh. No, in Dallas. And several cops were killed by the guy before they blew his ass up. There was
I remember that.
Like five cops.
And I went, this guy has military training. Everybody said, shut up, you don't know. I'm like, this guy has military training. Totally had military training, had it on Afghan deployments. And they basically sent the Claymore Roomba to get his ass, right? Like, he went behind a car in a parking garage, and they're finally like, you know what? We're not sending a SWAT team in. They went around with the robot with explosives on it, and they said, surrender or boom. And he said, I ain't surrendering, and boom. But you can understand it. I think it was five officers lost.
Five cops got killed.
Yeah, he was like a sharpshooter. He was just taking them out.
And then there were people all pissed at the
guys.
They were all mad at the police chief because he gave the order to blow the guy up. And his response was, I wasn't losing one more officer that day.
Good for him.
Yeah, yeah.
He should be hailed a hero for saving the rest of them who could have all been killed.
That was four officers too late, though. Between you and me. I want to say one thing, that you know that diluted Maalox is something that can give you relief if you wind up getting pepper sprayed by somebody.
Oh, like to pour on your face? Okay, right. I didn't know that either.
Right. They were a lot of these college protests, the Antifa guys actually carry pepper spray, and they have no problems pepper spraying the people with MAGA hats. So, you know, that's something.
I also don't like it when they get it back, though. I personally think, like, the other thing that I see, it's not happening that much in the United States, probably because we have a lot of people that will just drive over you. But it's happening in Europe, and usually what happens in Europe eventually happens here. All these people blocking roadways and stuff. This can be a serious, serious situation. Like, people say, well, they're peaceful. No, you're not being peaceful. Because it's not just that this guy might be late for work. The other guy next to him might be late checking in on his work release from prison and then back in prison because of you. The guy next to him is trying to get his wife to the hospital so she doesn't bleed out and die.
Right.
Like, these are serious problems, and I think everybody should carry pepper spray for that alone. Because if you block the road, I'm not shooting you over blocking the road, but I remember that scene back during the Occupy Wall Street protests where they had, like, they told them, okay, you've been here a month, you're clearing out, and they said no, and they all lined up, and the cop just walked by and just painted everybody in the face. I'll do it. You're blocking a highway. And I guarantee you, you'll move. Whenever I bring up pepper spray, people say, well, I know this guy, and he was Special Forces, and he used to put it on his food. And I'm like, I put fucking hot sauce on my food all the time. I don't want it in my eyes.
Yes. Or up into your airway. In your airway. When you're choking, you can't breathe. Yeah.
It is highly effective. And so it's not always instantly effective. Like, some people can take it, and they go a few seconds before it really. But I've never seen it used where within about 10 seconds, that person, even if they're still fighting, doesn't, especially if they've never experienced it before. Because it's pretty horrifying to be hit with mace or pepper spray if you've never experienced it before. And I've seen people, like, cough blood up, sneeze blood. Like, it will shut your shit down. And I've also seen cops spray, like, fights going on in the street in Austin or whatever. Cop just walks by and just, like, sprays everybody. And then just, like, steps back and waits a couple seconds. Two people are still going at it. Little bit more, and all of a sudden everybody shuts the fuck up and goes home.
Right.
So I like the Maalox idea for relief, but I also like the idea of carrying it because it's something you can use on somebody if you have to that is unlikely to unalive them, which is it's a burden you don't want to carry if you don't have to.
Right.
And most cops are like, well, why'd you pepper spray him? Well, he was trying to come at me and beat me with a stick. Okay. Yeah. That's the end of it. Like, oh, okay. All right, that's what it's for. Sorry about you. You might want to go to ER, dude. You know, and we'll you when you come out, you know, to arrest you for assault. Like, okay. I mean, I don't know how it is in California, but in Texas, that would be pretty much the entire conversation.
Right, exactly. Well, I was thinking also, you know, the Colorado. I mean, I think most of those people probably have hiked and all own bear spray. I can't imagine nobody thinking, let me bring some. I mean, it's mostly a Jewish group, and then those two young, Jewish couple in Washington, D.C. just got gunned down, what, a week ago? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is happening.
Oh, yeah, that happened too.
Anti-Semitism is violent. It's coming out, and people are doing more and more things.
Well, I think when you get into a stress situation, people tend to default to violence. And I think we're getting into many different levels of stress right now, some real. And unfortunately, a lot of it is imagined. And what I mean is that a lot of these people that are protesting over, let's say, Palestine and what's going on over there, I'm not going to argue with anybody about it. It's horrible. And mm-hmm. I wish it wasn't happening. But yeah. A lot of these people doing this shit, they don't really care. It's just the thing that they're outraged about today.
Today.
And they will be outraged about something totally different tomorrow. There's a lot of people in this country, they love protests because protests lead to riots. And riots lead to, I can get away with a lot of shit I normally couldn't.
Right.
And I think, like, this is why you should have a scanner app on your phone. You should have an actual scanner in your house. I don't really care about the next Kardashian's ass implant or whatever, so I don't watch TV for that. Have awareness at the macro, at like a national level of the shit that's going on, and have awareness of what's going on in your local area. And whenever you're traveling, then know along that pathway. Usually highways are pretty safe, but when you get off the highway to go into a town or something, if there could be all kinds of shit breaking loose that you're unaware of. Right. Yep. And you should make sure you know about that in advance. And then the best, what did Miyagi say in Karate Kid? Best block is no be there. Right.
Don't be there. Right.
Where the punch is and you won't get hit.
There you go. Right.
You know,
prevention.
Wise man, Mr. Miyagi.
So you guys want to let everybody know how, I mean, you guys are on the show all the time with expert counsel stuff and all, but we get new people all the time. How can people find out more about you, get your book? And your med kits, and maybe Amy could talk about the med kits because I know she personally packs them.
Well, this is a way to say the website, Doom and Bloom.
Okay.
Doomandbloom.net. That's our company name. Doom and you can do doomandbloom.com. I own that too, but I had doomandbloom.net first. That's the main webpage. That's where all the articles that Dr. Bones writes, Mr. Joe. And it has links to everything. We do have a podcast. We don't do as regularly as you do, although he is trying to motivate us to do that more. We have a YouTube channel. Again, links you can get off of Doom and Bloom. We have a store that is separate, but you can click on find the medical kits on doomandbloom.net. And we have a store that has kits from little IFACs, pocket kits, all the way up to giant, on that picture, you're showing me what I'm holding is one of the big backpacks. Yep. And then you can scroll down and then find articles, find the podcasts. We're on Spreaker now because Blog Talk shut down. And, Joe, he is a writing magician here.
I just want to make
sure. It's all from his brain.
Make sure we know that, you know, that it's not, we don't just have this one book. We have other books on infectious disease, pandemic preparedness.
Yeah, do the antibiotics.
All sorts of different books. And, you know, we're proud to say that.
And Snowy, a children's book. That's so cute.
Yeah. So.
Those are some of the sizes of books that are.
We're proud of this book. This book has been out since in one edition or another. In
2012, before,
since
it was the first one.
2012, today it was number one in emergency medicine.
Those are some of the books we recommend.
And these are some of the books that we recommend.
Yeah, number one in emergency medicine is pretty amazing because you can imagine the medical books that are there.
Yeah.
So
we're very very proud of her book. And
we poured our heart and soul. This was our COVID project. Joe ripped that book open one day, and I was like, "What are you doing? Like, you got nothing else to do."
Yeah.
So we pulled all the chapters out and laid them out all over the dining room table, and we went through each chapter. We pulled out a whole list of all the articles he had written since the last book, which was 2015, and we decided what to add, what to rewrite. I added hundreds and hundreds of physiology and anatomy pictures in here. So when we talk about abdominal stuff, there's a whole anatomy and picture graphic with.
But it's important to know
names
that if you have
where everything is.
If you have a fifth grade education, you can read this book and understand it.
Easy.
This is meant to be easy to understand.
It's not on the level of people who went to medical school. It's on the level of, I never had any medical training. What do I do? You can understand this book. It's easy to read. It's easy to understand. That's the Amazon.
Yeah, we're still 4.8 out of 8, out of 5, over more than 3,700 reviews.
And so their bestseller rank, like they were saying today, number one in emergency medicine and books, number three in reference in books, number three in survival and emergency preparedness on Amazon. And that's out of, you know, millions of categories there. Hell, their book is number 3,000 in all books, and there's about 55 million book titles on Amazon. That's impressive.
We have been as high as 27 or 22.
Yeah, we hit the high.
I think
that's our high. But
out of the 55 million,
you know, now that
was during COVID.
And the funny thing is that, you know, our ranking is a little lower now than usual, and that's because of Trump. Because people feel that somehow there's like a sigh of relief.
They're safe.
They think they're safe, but the truth is they're not safe. And so it's important.
It's all this weird stuff.
It's important to know this stuff, and you know, this is one at least one place you can find it.
Let me say one more thing. That this version, the fourth edition, I did do in color. So there's color pictures here versus the old one. The black and white is on Amazon, which is what you showed. The color version is only on my store, the store.doomandbloom.net. And I have just a paperback in color, and I also have this spiral bound. And they actually hand bind this. They actually hand cut this because it's so thick, and they put the spiral in. But it's nice because then you can lay it open.
Yeah.
While you're doing what you need to do, you can read the directions.
There's a lot of
how to handle
step-by-step stuff.
Yeah, but like here's the anatomy pictures of where everything is. Which I think is great because before you read the chapter, you see where everything is anyway.
So I think one of the, like, just as we're wrapping up here, this is an excellent comment. It's sad, but it's excellent given the topic. Jesse S., who I think is like an EMT or paramedic, something like that, said, "We ran out of tourniquets during the tornado in London, Kentucky, and we're using belts and ratchet straps for amputations."
Wow.
Now, that's right. Not any of the crap we were talking about. That's not a terrorist with a bioweapon. That's not a lunatic with a homemade freaking garden sprayer flamethrower. Like, that's just nature. And, you know, there is times when the people coming to help you will do their best, but they too have resource limitations, personnel limitations. I like the way Joe put it at the beginning. If you are in a two ambulance town and there's three emergencies and you're number three, you have a problem. Right. And that is a reality. And I think that's becoming more the case. A lot of places are resource starved. We are in a declining population, and a lot of people think that's good. No, it's not. That means there's less people to be EMTs. There's less people to be paramedics. There's less people to be nurses and nurse practitioners and doctors and surgeons and teachers of the same.
And that's why our mission is to put a medically prepared person in every family. I mean, somebody not only with the knowledge, but also with the supplies to be able to use in times of trouble.
And to help your community.
And to be there for your community. You know. Absolutely.
I got a couple quick questions, and then we'll let you guys go. Tom says, do Do you guys talk about using hemostatic dressings like Quick Clot in the book?
Absolutely.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Boy, do we. But that's one of our most extensive sections is trauma, because what are you going to die from in this book? What are you going to die from like that? Bleeding.
So bleeding is one of the five leading causes of death.
We have heart attack and CPR in here too, but yeah. Bleeding. And bleeding is something you could stop without having the ambulance come if you know what you're doing. You know, and there's.
I will say that I have personally tested Quick Clot and it works.
Good.
We had an old Dodge truck that the hydraulic pistons that hold the hood up were weak and they didn't hold the hood up. And I heard a cat crying in the truck and I lifted the hood and the cat was sitting on the air filter. And even though I knew it was weak, like just instinctively grabbed the cat and the thing came down and the actual, like the hook that holds the truck down hit me straight in the top of the head.
Oh my gosh.
It wasn't terrible. Okay, there we go. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't even extremely painful, but head wounds bleed a lot. So I'm like, well, let's see. And it was instant. It burned a little, but it was instant. It was much better than rubbing dirt on it like we did back in the 80s.
Yeah. Now, I will say that we actually have video. We have a video channel called DR Bones Nurse Amy on YouTube. And in there, we have a video on how to make your own hemostatic dressing.
It takes up a whole page.
From Kaolin and from Kytosam.
Okay.
So we absolutely, the principles of tourniquet use, when to use it, when not to use it.
So even when they run out, you can still make your own with
MacGyvering. I have a whole thing on improvised tourniquets right here. Improvising how to make tourniquets. So
like Jesse said, they were using belts and ratchet straps. You gotta do what you
gotta do. Yeah, right? I mean, things will work if you tighten it up enough and you know, use it wide enough, it will work.
And then Jesse said, will there be links to reliable companies? He's talking about those med kits. The ones that have the kits with the antibiotics.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's like
I'm not really gonna link
five or six of them.
I don't want to offhanded endorse by proxy with those companies. What Joe and Amy said, guys, is true. They all look the same. So are all the same. So they look like a product that's on, like, you find a product on Alibaba and then you go look for it on Amazon and it's got 400 brand names and it's all the same.
It's a brand, right.
Flashlight or radio or whatever. So I would say that, you know, they have utility. If there's a less expensive way you can put your stockpile together, do it. But if you really want one, then base it on the contents of the kit. Read the contents, understand it, and make your own choice. Because I don't want to buy Clotsy and endorse any of these companies. I don't have enough knowledge of any of them to say use this one.
Do you know who Dr. Drew is? Have you heard of Dr. Drew?
Yeah.
He's like a psychologist. He
reminds me of the dude from Ferris Bueller, the teacher, Bueller.
Yes.
Okay. He's endorsing one of those kits.
Okay.
But he reads this thing, and instead of saying respiratory infection, he goes respiratory.
Respiratory.
I was like, dude, if you don't know how to pronounce the word respiratory, you should not be talking about medicine. Go back to your mental health therapeutic thing. You're probably really good therapist, but you should not be talking about giving medicine when you can't pronounce respiratory.
Yeah.
Sorry.
If you want to know which antibiotics that I recommend, I have my top five in an article called Which Antibiotics Should You Have? And that is on our website at doomandboom.net.
There you go. All right, guys. Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Jack.
It was wonderful with you.
Shameless plug for
my book.
Laws of Life.
That's right.
Get it.
Get your copy today. Yeah. And if you bought your copy last week or earlier, it's got the errors in it. Don't be mad about the errors. You have a collector's edition. That's the
there you go.
That's right.
It's like a dollar bill that was misstamped.
Yeah, it's the 1909 penny with the error. It'll never
be
there. Jack, we have a book here. We have here a book here that, let's see, is this it? This is
my gosh. This is hilarious.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Okay, there's the front cover.
Okay.
You open it up.
It's upside down.
Can you tell?
It's upside down.
Upside down.
And it begins.
The chapters are down there.
And it begins with the last page.
Oh, okay. They did it in verse.
Look at that.
Y'all need to see. Y'all need to auction that. Auction that off. It's a fundraiser for Joe and Amy's next vacation.
It's the only one.
Donated to an old man and a wonderful wife of his.
That was so funny.
All right, guys, take care.
Thanks for having us.
All right, love you guys. Love everybody out there. Be safe.
Bye now. All right, guys, real quick, I want to just wrap up with you. And, they're very nice to mention my book. My item of the day actually is somebody else's book, but I'm doing a three-day series of books on money. Yesterday, the item of the day was The Fiat Standard by Saif Dean Amos. And I'm putting these books in the order I believe they should be read, which is the exact opposite order that I read them in. So I read The Bitcoin Standard. Then I read Broken Money, and then I read The Fiat Standard. So I really think The Fiat Standard is the first book to read in this trilogy, even though it's not actually a trilogy because there's two different authors involved. But The Fiat Standard really does a great job of breaking down not just the problems with fiat money, but all of the problems that it caused, how it's in everything. Lind Alden's book that I'm going to recommend as the second book to read if you really want to understand money and our modern problems and the solutions to them goes through the entire monetary history of things. It goes back to the giant stones they used on the islands. It goes through the hawala system, which is still used today to transfer money across borders with no interference. It's completely private, and into all of the problems with fiat. But one of the most important things you'll take away from this book is I want you to think about how deep this really is. Our money is broken. I think most people that have any understanding of how modern fiat money works, how it multiplies, how it moves through the system, how it's expanded, how every time it's expanded, it's sucking value from the old. We call that inflation. But we understand the money's broken. But have you ever thought about it this way? Half of every transaction that humans interact with each other with is money. Half. 50% of every transaction, if you go buy my book or Lynn's book or Doc and Bones' book, or Bones and Amy's book, or if you go buy a kit of antibiotics, if you buy a hat, if you buy a gun, if you buy a car, if you buy a boat, half of the transaction is money. And if the money's broken, then that means that everything's broken, literally. Like our food system is broken. Our medical system is broken. And it has to be broken because half of the damn transaction is based on something that's broken. So we'll never fix these problems until, what do you have to do when you're an addict? Admit your problem, right? We have a fiat addiction, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. Like, you're going to basically live in this disaster nonstop going forward. So you need an off-ramp. Now, Bitcoin is the eventual off-ramp, in my opinion. But if it's not Bitcoin, then it's some form of hard asset. But you're not going to be able to take the right steps until you diagnose the problem. Just like a doctor. When a doctor says, I'm going to give this guy medication, he doesn't say, hey, look, he looks sick. Give him, XYZ pill. You have to match the medication to the illness. And sometimes the situation is he doesn't need medicine. He needs like a bone set or something like that. To fix your life and to fix the half of all the problems in your life that are based on everything you do that's transactional, has broken money in it, read Lynn Alden's book. It is one of the most eye-opening and fascinating reads you will ever have. It's available in Kindle. It's available in a hard or soft copy, soft cover, and it's also available in audiobook. Books like this, I tend to consume in audio format, so that might be the way you want to do it. But in any event, you can get over to Amazon from tspaz.com and find her book. You can also see the prior write-up that I did from Saif Dean's book, The Fiat Standard. And then tomorrow I'll be bringing you The Bitcoin Standard. Anyway, with that, remember, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. And if you're going to pick up a book today, hey, pick up my book too. Pick up Bones and Amy's book too if you don't already have them. And thanks for tuning in today. And I will catch you guys tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. The American way. Don't
dollar down, a dollar a month.